Yeah, it's an exhilarating song, that one.
It is.
All right, we are in the Gospel of John, a series that I wanted to give a long time ago and have now justified that, you know, myself that the time is now. And we are into the first sign that John gives, which is turning water into wine. And I've subtitled it, The Attack on the Jerusalem Temple, Part B, because I started last week with what was, of course, Part A. And if you're wondering what I'm doing here, I'm actually looking for something that I seem to have lost, which is typical. Oh, here it is. The first sign is all about conversion. It's water into wine. It's a conversion process. But you can't have the first sign without knowing the implications and the ramifications of each of the signs that John the Apostle gives. And in this case, conversion, turning water into wine, leads directly to cleansing. And in the historical process, most Christians are not aware that Yeshua, when he cleansed the temple, quote-unquote, when he purified the temple, quote-unquote, actually attacked it, all right? He actually took up strength and power in the form of associates, and we'll talk about them today, and actually attacked the temple environs. And,
can I just say something? It's interesting that I can remember former teaching and former understanding of priests and pastors alike.
Sure.
They would always gloss over that.
Oh, very quickly.
His ministry.
That's right.
He was God, and, you know, well, he was acting on God's behalf. And,
that's right.
Because they couldn't handle the fact that he'd taken up a whip and gone hard at these.
And gone hard. That's right. It says he made a whip out of cord.
Yeah.
You know, which is rather interesting. But as we experience the blood of the Messiah, and gain salvation from it, that conversion experience has to lead to a corresponding cleansing. Now, I'm not talking about being cleansed by the blood of the Lamb. I'm talking about conversion through the blood of the Lamb. Yes, a cleansing takes place at that time by the Holy Spirit. No doubt about that, as we are declared legally right, legally righteous in the eyes of God. But after that, we have to go through a process on a daily basis of washing our robes. And Peter tells us we wash our robes with the water of the Word. Slightly different to the blood of the Messiah. One makes you right or declares you righteous in the sight of God. The other has to do with your moral propensity toward that which is natural, which God would call evil. That is, things we see in our nature, in our moral disposition, that doesn't really correlate with God's expectations of us. This heat of summer really gets to me. And I've got a short fuse. And so I become belligerent, I become agitated. Unless the Robertson says, Les pulls me into gear, pulls me into line, she's very good at that. I react, don't think otherwise.
And make a whip out of court.
Promises. But at the same time, I have a very short fuse, and I find myself in the heat exploding. That's the flesh. That's my nature. And I have to make sure, because I know what the word said. It says, control your mouth, control your temper, keep it under lock and key. And I find that very hard to do in weather like this, and particularly with Meniere's disease, as I've got, because as the heat continues in an aggravated way, it swells the inner ear, areas of the inner ear, and then I lose my balance, and then I'm back to lying on the bed with a fan over me trying to stay alive, because you're all over the shop. So my cleansing has to be on a daily basis in weather like this, in that area. But there are other areas of my human nature which stink, and you're the same.
You have to renew our minds daily.
Sorry?
We have to renew our minds daily.
It's a daily thing. Absolutely it is. This involves so-called Christian living. You know, people use that term, Christian living. Well, Christian living simply means, hey, look, get it right. Act correctly. Be proactive. Communicate with people. Don't cut them off. Don't be aggro. Be friendly. You want to smash somebody, but just be friendly. Okay?
Be friendly and then smash them.
But, you know, the point of the matter is we do need to grow in grace and knowledge. But anyway, getting back to where we are in this flow, we're now in the 10th lecture of the Gospel of John, and I want to talk today about Yeshua's zealot connections. This is most important so that we can understand properly the biblical revelation. Recently I was at a bookshop and looked at some of the titles about Jesus. And one of them had to do with him as a leader or fomenter of rebellion in the Roman province of Judea. And I looked at it and I flipped through it and I looked at some of the texts that they were using and I thought, you know, it's about time someone came out and really communicated about the historical Yeshua the Nazarene, King of the Jews. Because I did this many years ago, you'll remember that probably, you and Laurel, I gave a lecture on the zealots a long, long time ago.
You asked me what a zealot was.
And you said it was something you were zealous.
No, I said somebody that's very zealous.
That's right. So I took some of that information and I've put it together in a different format now so that we can properly understand the consequences of turning water into wine and the cleansing of the temple. Most important, because people never go back to the actual miracle. They talk about Yeshua doing this or Yeshua doing that or thinking this or thinking that or whatever. But they don't actually come back to the miracle itself and the fact that what Yeshua was doing was initiating a most important sign of his authority as a Messiah, as the Messiah. But look, it's my contention. Now, I mentioned this recently, that prior to the Jewish-Roman War, John had written a number of pre-gospel gospels. Now, I know I mentioned that recently, and Owen lifted his eyebrows up as if, what? What was that? But pre-gospel gospels. And to convince his priestly colleagues, because John was a priest, known to Caiaphas, and he wanted to convince his priests that the Sanhedrin recognized formally the office of Yeshua as the Messiah. This is not understood by Christians today. But Caiaphas recognized Yeshua was the Messiah. When we get to the final sign, the seventh sign, which should be in about 4 years from now, when we finally get there, I'll prove that point. But this was a period of time when a lot of people who had known Yeshua were writing little biographies and circulating their recollections all around the Galilee and Judea. And some of these people obviously had been healed in his ministry when Yeshua was around, and they were writing little stories. And it was these stories, these collections of little proto-gospels, that finally incubated into what is now known as the synoptic tradition. In fact, if you look at Luke chapter 1, this will be familiar to all of you, Luke chapter 1, we find that the physician Luke collected or went around verifying and comparing certain gospels, stories that were circulating at the time. And he wanted the truth of the matter about Yeshua. In fact, in chapter 1 of Luke, in verse 1, it says, "For as much as many," now please notice, many, not just a few, a lot of people, "many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, even as they delivered them unto us, who were from the beginning eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me as well, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto you in order, most excellent Theophilus," wherever he was, "that you might know the certainty of those things wherein you have been instructed." So Luke went around and he started collecting the stories, and he started putting them together. And he would have been verifying the accounts if there were two or three stories that were the same. How do I know that to be the truth of the matter? Because in Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15, if you go back to the Sinai Torah, you'll see the practice as it was understood in the Second Temple period. Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15, it says clearly, "One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, in any sin that he sins. Only at the mouth of two witnesses or the mouth of three witnesses shall a matter be established." Tell you what, I wish that was the case today. A variety of witnesses, not just one person turning around and going,
"I saw him down there." Well,
start a rumour. And we know that this principle was utilised in a positive way in the early messianic movement, because if you turn to Matthew 18 and verse 16, in Matthew 18 and verse 16, we find an outline of the discipline of believers in the early Matthean circle of faith. It's written, "If your brother shall trespass against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. But if he shall hear you, you've gained your brother. But if he will not hear, then take with you one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word will be established." You see, this is how far it went in the early discipline of the ecclesia. All right? And you'll find in 2 Corinthians, this carried over into the Pauline community, because you find in 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1 the principle being applied here. Paul says in chapter 13 of 2 Corinthians verse 1, he says to the Greeks in Corinth, "This is the third time I am coming to you. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. I told you before and foretell you, as if I were present the second time, and being absent now, I write to them which heretofore had sinned, and to all other, that if I come again, I will not spare." And okay, Paul's he's a bit short in his leash at the moment. He wants to make a point. But notice the principle, two or three times something was emphasized. So I know that when Luke sat down and looked, as a Jewish proselyte, looked through all the stories of the life of Yeshua, he found where two agreed or three agreed, he would incorporate that. Where there was only one story, maybe about Yeshua making little birds of clay and throwing them in the air and they fly away, like some of the stories that the early Catholic Church promulgated and circulated, he would have rejected those out of hand. So by the time the Emperor Domitian came along, John, the priestly John, remember, he's a priest, writing to his priestly colleagues, he had collated all his earlier gospel accounts, all those proto-gospels, into a redaction that we know today as the Gospel of John. Right? Now, you might say, well, the other day you mentioned that he had penned these earlier gospels. What's the proof of that? Well, the proof is in the fact that in his gospel you'll find traces of statements where he refers to specific geographical locations or specific topographical locations in the current present tense, as if they were there when he wrote. But we know that by the time of Domitian, when we have the Gospel of John in its present form, those places no longer existed that he referred to, or they were lost as a result of the Jewish-Roman War. Therefore, it is evident he's taken earlier writings and incorporated them into his gospel, but has not changed the current present tense in which he wrote those original works. All right? And so that becomes very apparent, that he is collecting all his early writings and turning them into a redaction, which we know today as the Gospel of John. And of course, in this final volume, John gives his colleagues, those priestly colleagues who still remain alive, because in Domitian's time, you would have been in your 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, if you were young in the period of the Jewish-Roman War, he gives them seven signs to remind them of the signs that proved to the Sanhedrin that Yeshua was the Messiah. And this is overlooked by commentators today. It's overlooked, largely overlooked. Now, after John's second disappearance, and if you're going to say, what is that all about? Well, you're going to have to go to the Apocalypse lectures and have a look at that. After his second disappearance, a disciple called Papias came along and added chapter 21 to the Gospel of John. Now, just to remind you, if you go over here to John and look at chapter 20, that's right, yep. We need to be reminded. We might say, oh, we know this. Well, we need to be reminded at the same time. Sorry?
In the codex.
Yes. So, after the account where Yeshua shows himself to Thomas, in verse 30 of chapter 20, John writes, many other signs truly did Yeshua in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Yeshua is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. That's where the gospel ends. That's where John completes it. That's where the gospel finishes. But then, chapter 21 is tacked onto it, where another sign is given. And when you look very carefully at what Papias has added, you find that it is a sign that establishes the early ecclesia, and particularly the Johannine community, into a proper understanding of God's expectations. And I find that most intriguing. And all authorities, if you have a look at, maybe even in your own Bibles, it'll have a little reference down the bottom, probably saying chapter 21 is a later addition. Right? Maybe it doesn't say that, but a lot of Bibles have it in there, to their credit. But John redacted his gospel at Ephesus, or Ephesus, in Asia Minor, which was proconsular Roman Asia, long after the Jerusalem temple had been destroyed. And you'll find a tension all the way through the Gospel of John, like one minute the temple's there and everything's happening around the temple, but later on you realise from in a retrospective way that the temple has been gone a long time. And John's account of the fig tree, we're not going to talk about that today, we're going to talk about that in our next lecture. The fig tree is very important when it comes to this first sign and the ramifications of it. Very important in relation to the destruction of the temple of God in Jerusalem. The fig tree has been ignored by commentators for too long, and I want to focus on that, because the fig tree gives everyone the reason why John believed the temple and its services, with the Jewish ceremonial and ritual observances, were no longer valid. Because we cannot get away from the fact that John records Yeshua cursing the fig tree. And the fig tree is the symbol of the priestly power and political power of Israel, of the Jewish state in the Second Temple period. And Yeshua cursed it, which many Jews at the time said, he can't be the Messiah because he cursed the house of God. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And he took to himself, and rightly so, the office of high priest out of the hands of the representative of God at that time, whose name was Caiaphas. And I'm going to be talking about that down the track, because I don't want one stone left unturned in relation to the historic Yeshua. Too many people have come so close to understanding this and have backed off because of its ramifications. I won't back off. And you might say, you're too confrontational. Well, I'll handle that in my own way. But the fact that remains that the truth of God has to be restored by us at this time. And oh my, we have restored so much of it. Our site, more and more people are going to it. More and more people are questioning what they've been told over the years and come to an understanding that they're being told fairy tales. And I've never been one for fairy tales. I just haven't. I want the truth. At any cost. And even if that sometimes goes against my own colleagues out there in the Jewish world. A lot of them are in, and family, friends, neighbours, whatever. I believe this series on the Gospel of John that I'm giving is the most important I've ever given, because we are helping to restore the historic Nazarene King of the Jews as he really was in the Second Temple period. That's no mean feat, I'll tell you. It's given the rabbits and I some tension because we've had to take apart, analyse, and put back together again what the biblical revelation states. Because all of us here come from various backgrounds, and we have with us in our views the propensity to adopt what other people have taught us. But when you get to the actual biblical revelation and read what it says, sometimes you can get such a shock. You sit back and go, you know what I just read, Glenis? What? Blah, 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 blah. No. Yes. Oh, you're reading that into it. No, I'm not. So then we have this great, beautiful, wonderful discussion. And I wish more husbands and wives were like that, where you can get down into the nitty-gritty and take things apart. Right? This is probably the strength of our marriage, the fact that we communicate when so many people don't communicate.
Solution.
Sorry?
We seek solution.
Mm-hmm.
Our inquiring mind seeks a
if
solution to the matter.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Even if you have to fight it out, find the solution to the fight.
Well, yes. As strange as that sounds, yes. If any of you have access to the board and you want to know about Isaiah's 65-year failed prophecy, go back and do some reading about that 65-year prophecy. It's in Isaiah. It's in Isaiah chapter 7, I think 7, 8, and 9, verse 7, 8, and 9. Isaiah gave a prophecy about a 65-year period that never was fulfilled. It had to do with Emmanuel, and it never was fulfilled. Now, I have referred to it all the way through, well, not all the way through, but instances through the apocalypse. And I'm doing it again now in this series, because I came across this prophecy and I took the bull by the horns and had a good look at it. And I must be the only person on the face of the earth, to my knowledge, who has uncovered the reason why the Zealot War in 66 occurred. And so important is this information that we need to get three books published. We need to get the real Apostle Paul published. We need to get the Apocalypse. It is 140 volumes published. And we need to get the Gospel of John, this series, published. We must get it published, because no one else has this information. We have it. And we have a corner on the market in relation to it, bear my words, as prophetic today, because the whole world in a few years' time are going to sit back and say, oh my, look at this. Because Isaiah's prophecies at the very end of the age refer to a small work restoring the knowledge of the first century and applying that knowledge to the last century. And I can prove that to you in Isaiah. And it's interesting, he says, none says at the end of the age, none says restore. Well, I'm saying restore. We need to restore the word of God. And we're doing a good job of it, even if I say so myself. But immediately after the demonstration of Yeshua's authority over nature in his act of transmuting water into wine, remember, he demotes the six water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, quote unquote. Remember that, don't ever lose sight of that. With its obvious spiritual ramifications relative to the insipidity. Good word? The insipidity of Second Temple Judaism's watery, flesh-washing, Torah-cleansing principles. The Messiah attacks the Jerusalem temple in an overt attempt to purify and to cleanse the environs. I'm not going to turn, because of the time element today, because we're running pretty late, I'm not going to turn to these scriptures. Take a mental note on paper. Make a mental note on paper of Matthew 21, Mark 11, and Luke 19, and John chapter 2. It's up there on the whiteboard. In your spare time, just read through the accounts of the four Gospels in relation to the temple purification, and read what each of the authors say, and compare them. I find that absolutely fascinating. When you sit down and compare four different accounts of the one incident. And remember, John has taken that attack on the temple and transferred it from the last week of Yeshua's life, which brought about his crucifixion. He's taken that and put it right at the very beginning of the ministry of Christ. All right? But he's done it for a reason, because this whole book is about signs. And he wants to prove a point, and he uses Semitisms to do so. And in other words, he's exaggerating by saying that happened at the beginning of his ministry. But he's teaching something, and this is what is most important to understand. But Christians have been fed a very steady diet of a sanitized version of the events of that memorable day when Yeshua physically stormed the sacred temple precincts and armed with 900 zealots surrounding him. Now, you're going to say, where do you get that? Well, I'm going to show you in a minute. But he had 900 zealots who had adopted the ancient prophecy of Isaiah 7, verses 7 through to 9. They had adopted it, which spoke of, it's a prophecy that spoke of a mysterious 65-year period which has never in history been fulfilled. And they applied that prediction to their own movement and cause. And they took control of the religious headquarters of the Sanhedrin, which was the temple. And Yeshua temporarily prevented the continuation of the sacrificial system itself. And I showed you that in the last lecture. He would not permit anybody to walk through the temple sacred precincts with a vessel. Well, the only vessels that would be carried through the temple at that time were for the sacrificial system to be operating. And Yeshua prevented it. Okay? So no temple vessels equals no temple sacrifices. This would have been a major calamity, a major upset to the economy of Israel or of the state of Judea. But that's all overlooked when you read these books and commentaries about the purification and the cleansing of the temple. You'd think it was sort of like an everyday occurrence. No major issues were involved. There were enormous issues. And you might say, well, why didn't Rome intervene? Well, something happened at the same time as Yeshua did that, and I'm going to talk about that in the next lecture. Something happened at the same time. You're smiling. You obviously know what happened. But let me say this, that when Yeshua attacked the temple, he turned the world upside down. He turned the world upside down. And, it's going to come to a point. I'll come to that a bit later. But at this juncture, I want to point out some fascinating factors relative to the times in which Yeshua lived and which are often overlooked or they're ignored by expositors and scholars of the Christian faith. They are important adjuncts to a proper understanding of the biblical revelation. So I want you to take mental note on paper here of these things, because they're important. If you notice up here on the whiteboard, I've got a number of headings. I've got why Yeshua repeatedly was asked for a sign. All right, people don't think things through, but you know there's a reason why he was asked for a sign. And another point, significance of wilderness miracles that he performed. I've got another issue, the fourth philosophy and the Messianists, and then Yeshua's zealot friends. These four factors I want to talk about today. You might say, wow, what's the time allotment here? It's going to take as long as I can to utilize the... To get it out, exactly. Now, question. Why was Yeshua repeatedly asked for a sign? You know, when we read the Bible, we need to ask ourselves some questions. And this is one of them. Because everywhere Yeshua went, people dogged his steps, saying, give us a sign, give us a sign. I am the Messiah. Or are you just a naughty boy? It's his shoe, whatever. Life of Brian coming down. But the issue is, the Sadducees held the majority of seats in the Sanhedrin. The Pharisees had the majority, had the minority. The Sadducees, who were in the pay of Rome, controlled Judea through the Sanhedrin. Now, one of the responsibilities, I have yet to find a scholar who even mentions this. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong direction. But one of the responsibilities of the members of the Sanhedrin was to identify anybody who had messianic pretensions. And I use that word pretensions in the original meaning of the word. So I don't mean any disrespect. If they came across someone who professed to be the Mashiach, they were expected to do two things. One was denounce him. And secondly, demand a sign. Demand a sign to authenticate his office. Remember that. Denounce and demand a sign. Now you might say that's a very negative way of approaching it. Yes, but there was a reason for that. Because Yeshua lived at a time when messiahs were rising up all over the place and leading people astray. So the Sanhedrin were denouncing Yeshua and demanding signs because they wanted to protect the unschooled masses of the time who had high expectations of a coming Messiah who was going to deliver the people from the power of Rome. And especially was this the case in the mid to late Second Temple period. False messiahs came and went during that period of time. And credit has to be given, as far as I'm concerned, credit must be given to a very alert Sanhedrin to keep tabs on all these people. They inspected them, they gauged each so-called Messiah in their turn, and they all proved to be non-Messiahs. But understanding this historical expectation helps us to grasp why it was that the Sadducees... Well, they were Sadducees because they denied the resurrection. But and the Pharisees and the scribes, who were lawyers, that's what a scribe was, they were lawyers, often confronted Yeshua demanding a sign. They were doing their job. And this is a principal reason why John reminds his colleagues, his priestly colleagues, of the seven prominent signs Yeshua gave, which were selected by the Apostle of Love to both identify and authenticate his Lord's person and messianic calling. But remember this, out of all the synoptic miracles that Matthew, Mark and Luke record, John only takes one sign, and that was the feeding of the 5,000 in the wilderness. He uses that sign. He doesn't reject the others, he just grabs hold of one and says, I'm going to talk about this. And I find that really interesting. I'm going to say more about that in a second. But if you notice up here, the second heading I've got is significance of wilderness miracles. Now, this is important to understand because it was expected by the common masses that when the Messiah came, he would assemble all his followers in the wilderness, perform miracles, and create them into an armed force. Now, when you read one of the accounts in the Synoptics of the feeding of the 5,000, what does Yeshua do? He says, put them all in groups. Groups of 50s, groups of 100s, groups of 10s. This is intriguing, just like Moses in the wilderness. So here is Messiah assembling his followers, teaching them his discipline in the wilderness. Now, Josephus, in his Wars and Antiquities, mentions that the Messiah would assemble his followers into an armed force in the wilderness. They would then move from there to the Mount of Olives, and then they would then be in a stone's throw of the Roman fortress Antonia, or Antonia, which was set right against the temple, so that they would be in a position to attack Rome and overthrow it in Jerusalem itself. So it cannot be that Pontius Pilate, again, you've got to read between the lines here, it cannot be that Pontius Pilate, nor Herod as Caesar's friend, had ignored the activities of Yeshua during his ministry. That's stretching credulity. Because Pontius Pilate and Herod represented the government of Rome, right? So it cannot be that they ignored the activities of Yeshua, who had his headquarters on the Mount of Olives, and that's mentioned many times in the Gospels. He was always at the Mount of Olives, that's where he had his headquarters, and frankly, early history even tells us that the first ecclesia, the first church in Jerusalem, in those environs, was on the Mount of Olives. All right? He had assembled thousands in the wilderness for instruction in discipleship. This would not have been ignored by Pilate, nor by Herod. As I said, it strains intellectual credulity to believe otherwise. There would have been reports going back to Caesar all the time about this wonder worker of miracles who assembling 5,000 people at a time in the wilderness, teaching them. These reports would have been going back for years to Caesar.
Even today, if you did something like that, they'd have the helicopters flying
out. Well, yeah, the black helicopters would be... Yeah. Don't say that too loudly, we've got Oscar here. With his little...
There's a lot of them.
With a little microphone. Josephus tells us of at least two messiahs, who came from the wilderness intending to marshal their followers at the Mount of Olives, from the wilderness to the Mount of Olives, for an attack on the Roman fortress. He tells us of at least two. Herod would also have seen Yeshua's cousin, Yochanan the Immerser, or John the Baptist, as a formidable security risk for the same reason, because he originated in the deserts, in the wilderness of Judea, and he was ritually immersing his followers, countless thousands of them, in the River Jordan. They would have been going, red alert, look out, there's a problem over here, he's a wild prophet. Now, I know that John lost his head, literally, because of Herodias and Salome's dance. And that's true. But Herod killed him because he was a political upstart, and Josephus tells us that. So, you know, you've got to put the two together to get the full story. This brings us to the fourth philosophy and the people called Messianists that are mentioned by Josephus. This is important. All this background is important to understand Yeshua, who he really was. And I'm going to come to that very soon. In Antiquities, and again, if you want the actual references to Josephus here, whether it's Antiquities or the Wars of the Jews, see me later and I can give them to you, or just access it off the board. But Josephus mentions what he calls the fourth philosophy, arising amongst the Jews when the Romans internationalized Jerusalem. They internationalized Jerusalem when they came in to Judea in the year 6 CE. A very important date, and you'll see why in a minute. First of all, he speaks of the Essenes, sometimes called Essenes. But the Essenes were the first and foremost philosophy. Then he mentions the teachings of the Sadducees and that of the Pharisaic schools in third position. Then he says, there is a fourth philosophy, and it's been worrisome to the great scholars of the biblical revelation and the scholars of the history of the Jews of the mid to late Second Temple period, and also primitive ecclesiastical history. It's a worry to people who study that. But if we just took the time to sit down and look and see what Josephus wrote about the fourth philosophy, we will, I believe, be confident to identify it. In fact, I'm so confident I've even written some of the points that they believed in on the whiteboard. But before we progress at this point, and I hope you're following me, and if I'm going too fast, just put your hands up in the air and wave, because I don't want to go fast. Don't forget that Josephus was the brother of Nachdaimon Ben-Gurion, and therefore well acquainted with the Lord Yeshua and his school. And Nachdaimon, we know in the Bible as Nicodemus. Nicodemus. Those who followed the fourth philosophy, and over here, now before I say anything more, I'll repeat what I said in the announcements today. I do not want anybody going from here, or anybody listening to this overseas, to turn around and say, the Reb said you don't have to pay taxes anymore. I'm not about to say that. All I'm doing is saying, is telling you, sharing with you, what the believers of the fourth philosophy in the Second Temple period believed. Right. Those who adhered to the fourth philosophy believed that to pay tax to any human government was tantamount and equivalent to slavery. Alright? And they read 2 Samuel 24 to say that their belief was correct, because no Jew should be in a census by an occupying power. 2 Samuel chapter 24. And I've read 2 Samuel chapter 24, and I can see where they're coming from. All right? But having said that...
Well, how come when they took the law, they had to read up to the census, by the Jews?
Yes, it wasn't actually a census. It was a registration. And that was all that was, to register where you came from. But look at Matthew 17. And I want to show you this, because people overlook this. But in Matthew chapter 17, it is written that an incident took place involving authorities, government authorities, and Peter thought he was doing the right thing, and Yeshua picked him up by the shoulders and shook him. He wasn't happy. He blocked his entrance to the house and all that. Have a look at verse 24. When they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute, see, here's taxation. Those who received tribute came to Peter and said, does your master pay tribute or not? And Peter says, yes. Yes, he does. And when he tried to enter the house, that's the Greek, Yeshua prevented him. Now it's written in the aggressive tense. So he's not happy. You can't find gentle Jesus meek and mild here. No. He won't let him in. And he says, what are you thinking, Simon? Shimon, what are you thinking? Of whom do the kings of the earth take taxes or tribute? Of their own children or of strangers? Peter says to him, strangers. Yeshua said, then, Peter, the children are free. Notwithstanding, lest we offend them, always a good move, go to the sea, cast a hook, take up the fish that first comes up. When you have opened its mouth, you will find a denarius. That take and give to them for you and me both. But he's not happy, Jan. He's not happy. He is not happy. So it's rather interesting, in the light of those who adhered to the fourth philosophy, it's interesting that Yeshua's aggressive disappointment with Peter over his desire to pay tribute.
It's Roman tribute, isn't it?
Well, it's temple tribute, but the Romans are in charge of the Sanhedrin by their appointment of Sadducees.
Yeah.
So whichever way you go, it's a tax.
Instituted by God in relation to...
Well, there was a half shekel that had to be paid.
At the temple?
Yes. That's another story.
Why?
That's another story. It's to do with sacrifice of people serving in the armed forces and all of that. It's a shekel for their life. It's a ransom. But it's another story. I don't want to get sidetracked on it. But note in that section we have just read, note the deliberation by Yeshua over the matter of slavery and freedom. It's clearly there. It's clearly there. The second point I wish to make on this subject is that the fourth philosophy espoused that to submit to foreign rule was an act of idolatry and an open violation of the first commandment. Please notice up here on the whiteboard, submission to foreign rule is an act of idolatry. So this was accepted by the fourth philosophy according to Josephus. And they did not want to be idolaters. And the third point, they held that God will work synergistically through his obedient people if they would stand firm beneath God's theocracy, actively resisting their political oppressors. All right? That was their philosophy as well. And the fourth point, they taught that Israel, if they demonstrated their resistance to religious political dominance, God would work through them to finally establish his kingdom over all the earth. Now, I find it rather interesting in a book I read a few years ago called Bandits, Prophets and Messiahs, Popular Movements at the Time of Jesus by Horsley and Hansen, that they understood precisely these four principles that Josephus had well articulated in his books. These four issues were the beliefs of both the Zealots and the original Christians, the original Messianists. And this becomes interesting because of its implications. If they believed that back in the first century, should we today engage in the same philosophy? Yeah, okay, so the question is there. I'm only putting the question. I'm not saying that
Israel should resist dominance, God would use them to establish kingdom of God over earth. And may it read today, were Israel to resist the Americans, God would use them to establish kingdom of God over the earth.
The point taken. But intriguing, but they're not going to. And the Apocalypse tells us that the Edomites will continue to control the Jewish state until the end. So, now, this is where it becomes intriguing to my mind, because Horsley and Hansen, in that book that I just mentioned, said that the Roman-Jewish war was a new phenomenon, the Zealots suddenly rose up, and all of that. I disagree with their assessments. I disagree with every scholar on earth in relation to the Zealots. The Zealots were around at the time of the birth of Yeshua. Yeshua, if you read the very fine volume Star Over Bethlehem by Ernest Martin, the late Ernest Martin, a friend of mine, the proof is given in his book that Yeshua was born on Rosh Hashanah on 9/11 in 32 BCE. Rather interesting. Rather interesting. Because Josephus tells us that the fourth philosophy traced its origin to a star. Now, this is rather intriguing. The star is the star predicted by Balaam, a star out of Jacob. And Judas of Galilee rose up at the time of a star that showed itself in the heavens. According to Josephus, the uprising of Judas began in the year 6 CE when Rome internationalized Jerusalem. But the star didn't rise in 6 CE, it had already risen in the year 3, 2, or 1, as it really was, 1 CE. All right? I'm sorry, 1 BCE. Herod officially died in 4 BCE. New evidence shows that Herod didn't die in 4 BCE, he died in 1 BCE. There's an eclipse that has been undiscovered until very recently. If the star rose in 1 BCE, the star of Bethlehem, understood and prophesied and predicted by Balaam centuries previously, if that was the star that Judas of Galilee saw and was inspired to rise up against Rome in 6 CE, when the Romans took Jerusalem and internationalized it, then you add 65 years to that period of time, and you know what? You're going to come very close to the uprising against Rome in 66-65 CE. This is too much of a coincidence, to my mind. And that unfulfilled 65-year Isaiahic prophecy involves, if you look at it in Isaiah 7, verse 7, 8, and 9, it is referring to Ephraim, as symbolic of Judah, in a corrupt form, and Ephraim had to be destroyed. And so the Zealots had a fourth philosophy. That philosophy was, we need to train people for the great war between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, which is going to culminate history. Because we now know, as I've been talking about for decades, it's now being acknowledged by scholars, that, and I'm not going to get any recognition for this, but people who've known me for 30 years or whatever will know this is what I taught, that the Zealots were, in actual fact, the Essene military arm from Qumran. It's now being recognised officially. Well, that's cool. I won't get recognised for it, but I was correct. And that's all that matters. It shows God was working with me all those years ago. So, if Yeshua was born in 3-2 BCE, and the Star of Bethlehem rose up in the sky about 2 years later and guided the Magi, the astrologers, to the house where Yeshua is described as a toddler by Matthew at his mother's side, then the Magi absolutely did not visit him on Christmas Day, I'm telling you now. He was not in a manger when the Magi came. He was in a house, and he was already about 2 years old. And the irony of Matthew's account is that the visit of the astrologers to Herod confront the Jewish king, and he knows nothing about his own prophecies, his own people's prophecies. It took pagans to know that a Messiah had been born, and he turns around, he calls in his own astrologers and all of that, and he says, where's the Messiah to be born? He doesn't even know his own scriptures. And they go, oh, Bethlehem, in Bethlehem. Huh? You were going to say something, yeah?
Yeah,
there
was. You mean to say there was no nativity?
Oh, mate. The shepherds were there. But the wise men, they came a little later. And in fact, Henry Haley was well aware that by the time of the arrival of these prestigious foreign visitors, Yeshua would have been under 2 years of age and aware enough of his environment to be given gifts directly to him by these people, by these astrologers. In fact, it's Henry Haley that points out what other scholars at the time that he wrote understood about the nativity, the obvious fact that he was not in a manger but in a house. You can go to Haley's Bible Handbook in the 1965 edition and look on page 418, and Haley writes, he was not in a manger but in a house. There you go. They no doubt knew of Balaam's prophecy, says Haley, about a star out of Jacob. They were men of high standing, for they had access to Herod. There were probably more than three of them. At least they were with an entourage of scores or hundreds, for it would not be safe for a small group to travel 1,000 miles over desert wastes that were infested with bandits or even Jewish revolutionaries, you know. Their arrival in Jerusalem was of sufficient show of importance to stir the whole city. So here they come with this whole entourage, and they've got all these gifts and all this wealth.
It's a caravan.
It was a caravan.
They had to ask where it was anyway.
And they even had to... Well, where do you find a Jewish king? Let's go to Herod, now the king. Let's go to the palace. But then, of course, they go to where he is, and they are then told in a dream to get out of there. Don't go back this way, go that way, because you're going to kill you. So there's no doubt in my mind, because scholars look at the bandits at the time that roamed the deserts, they look at the Sicarii, they look at the Zealots, they look at the other riffraff, and they say that they're all unconnected. My argument is that Josephus, when he talks of the fourth philosophy, and he talks about bandits, he talks about Sicarii, he talks about Zealots, he talks about all of these people as connected. And it's my contention that they were all connected as revolutionary movements prior to the outbreak of the war, and that the link between them all was Yeshua. Now, you know, people will say, oh, rubbish. He was a man of peace. Well, Yeshua did say, I'm not here to bring peace, but a sword. Now, we understand what that meant, because we see it even in our own family, where the sword has been divided, right or wrongly, amongst family members. And all of us here have had problems with family members over your stand on this issue or that issue or the other issue. We've all had it. And so that sword of Yeshua is sometimes very bloody. In any event, every one of these points, these four points, convey views that correspond precisely to doctrinal alignments exhibited by the primitive messianic movement, discovered in the life and teachings of Yeshua, Paul, and James as well. But there is another point worthy of consideration, and that is, as you see up here, Yeshua had zealot friends. Now, this is where we get into murky water. Make no mistake. I've mentioned more than once in previous lectures given over decades, and again in today's introduction, that Yeshua had the support of 900 zealots in his attack on the temple. Now, how do we know this happened? How do we know? Well, something dramatic happened, which prevented the temple police, which modern Jewish sources tell us were at least 1,000. Now, stop and think. the Jerusalem temple police, 1,000 of them, did not intervene to stop Yeshua. He went through with a whip. He cast out the money exchangers. He let the pigeons get out of the cages. He tossed the money all over the place. He screamed at them all that they were making his father's house a den of iniquity, a den of robbers. Yet not one temple policeman intervened to stop him. Hello. Think about what we read. Not one intervened. Not one arrested Yeshua for this provocative behavior. In Luke's account, Yeshua not only sees the temple, but is in firm control of its environs even days later. I want you to look at Luke 20, verse 1, and just believe what's written there. Luke 20, verse 1. The historicity of this is astonishing. All right, so if you look at chapter 19, the last few verses, it's all about him storming the temple. And look at verse 47 of chapter 19. And he taught daily in that temple. So he's still in control of it, days later. days later. And it came to pass, verse 1, chapter 20, it came to pass that on one of those days, you know, one of those days that he's in control of the temple, as he taught the people in the temple, see, he hasn't left it. he's still in control. As he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, the chief priests, yeah, the Sadducees, and the scribes, yeah, the lawyers, came to him with the elders and said to him, tell us, well, what authority do you do these things? Who gave you this authority? Yeah, you see, he's still in control, and they're very polite. They're not going to step out of bounds and challenge him. They're not going to arrest him. They're not going to intimidate him. They're not game to. Why? Because of a man who uttered beautiful sayings about little sparrows and mustard seeds, you know, and other lovely stories is a threat? What happened to the 1,000 temple police? Why weren't they intervening? He's in firm control of the environment. Look, the temple police don't even issue a restraining order. they don't even issue a restraining order against the Messiah. He's in full control and he's teaching the people in the temple. The Sadducees are very polite in directing their questions concerning his authority in this same period. They're not game to step out of bounds. But people don't ask why. Well, use your imagination. If he had 900 zealots surrounding the temple, none of them would have been game to step out and upset him. Whichever way we cut it, in Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, there is an undercurrent of relationship between Yeshua and the zealot movement which surfaces and resurfaces every time you read the gospel accounts, and no scholar can satisfactorily answer it.
Because they wanted him to declare himself so that they could all run rampant through the city and get back our homeland with the Messiah.
Well, we'll come to that in a second. We're informed by the church historian Lucius Lactantius. If you want to look him up on Google or in your history books, he lived around 250 to 325. Right? He guided the Emperor Constantine in regard to the development of religious policy, and he penned a two-volume work during the reign of Diocletian, which would have been around 245 to 315 CE. And he says that an unnamed authority, and this is thought, according to historians, this is thought to be the prefect of Egypt and the administrator of Bithynia, Socinus Heraclius. He says, and he obviously has access to a still circulating corrupt tradition, that Yeshua had gathered about him 900 extremists. Now, this is an interesting tradition because it shows that the tradition is still circulating all those years later. And Socinus Heraclius makes a point of this. And Yeshua gets the blame for ravaging Palestine with these zealots. And people go, well, what on earth is that all about? Well, the Jews, even to this day, still blame Yeshua for the Roman-Jewish war. And they're not wrong in blaming Yeshua for the Roman-Jewish war, because it was Yeshua who cursed the fig tree and brought about the zealot revolution that brought about the destruction of Judea. Right. And Judea, as I will point out in the next lecture, was the showplace of the Roman Empire. The showplace of the Roman Empire. If you watch Cecil B. DeMille, you watch Ben-Hur, you watch any of these shows about the first century Judea with Jesus there with his long flowing locks and his petulant curls and effeminate features. If you look at this person in light of Hollywood, he lives in an area which is decrepit. People walk around in rags and sandals, you know, dirty place, dust and stuff. Dirty hovels that people live in. It wasn't like that. If you read Josephus and the accounts at the time, Jerusalem was the showplace of the Roman Empire. It was the wealthiest city on the face of God's earth. And when it fell, when it collapsed, all of Mediterranean Rome went into inflation. Inflation soared, yes. Oh.
Into recession.
The whole place collapsed. Massive migrations of whole nations swept across Europe. The Samaritans, there were 6 million of them, they disappeared. We can trace them historically. They settled all around through the Mediterranean and southern Italy and all of that, the Samaritans. Astonishing. I love history. But I wish some Hollywood directors got it right.
Yeah.
I wish that the streets were virtually paved with gold. That's an exaggeration, but the streets were made of marble. The temple, Josephus even describes the temple of God. He says, the place, if you were coming from a long distance, you would see it like a white mountain as the sun rose. It blinded your eyes because it was made of white marble with gold. Yeah, it blows your mind. The wealthiest place on the face of the earth was Jerusalem, not Rome. Not Rome.
Yeah. Reading that account in Luke 20
sure.
gives more direction that it did happen at the beginning of the ministry because they didn't know who he was, it says. And then they asked me all this, but before that in chapter 19, they certainly knew who he was.
If you look at the whole thing in Luke chapter 19, chapter 20, and chapter 21, this is the last week in Yeshua's ministry.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, but they knew who he was by then.
Yeah, but they kept asking, they kept adding, because they wanted him to admit that he was the Messiah openly. And that's why they were saying, if you are, you know.
That would have sent him to the cross earlier because it would be blasphemy.
That's right. And don't forget that Yeshua, when he finally said, yes, I am the Messiah, when he finally said it, Rome crucified him, but for 6 hours, the Jewish priests and others stoned him. So he was literally stoned to death for blasphemy while he was being crucified by the Romans. Hideous. Because, you know, Pilate said to them, go ahead and you do it. You guys, you go ahead, you priests, you go ahead and do it. Fulfill your law. What was their law? Stoned to death for blasphemy. So he was not only crucified, but he was stoned as well. And if the synoptics are correct and took 6 hours, what an agonizing time Yeshua had on that tree. And remember, too, John tells us that the insurrectionists that were crucified with him were crucified on the same stawos. So if it was a cross, you would have three people hanging off the one cross. It's absolutely ridiculous. If it was a tree, and the Greek word is xylon, meaning a tree, then he would have been crucified on the tree, which was a common implement of crucifixion in the Second Temple period. Another one would have been on one side, another one on the other side. Because when the Romans came, they went to first to that one, then to that one, breaking their legs. When they came to Yeshua on the same tree, on the one staros, and the one tree, crucified, nailed up there, they found he was already dead, so they didn't bother breaking his leg. But if you read the Syriac Gospel of Matthew, you find that the spear thrust is what actually killed him. Inside. So, according to Socinus Heracles, and the tradition that he had even all those years later, there were 900 zealots associated with Yeshua. So it's not stretching a long bow, because that would to speculate that that's what happened. Because as I said, there were 1,000 police in the Jerusalem temple. Not one of them restrained him. Now, we know that Yeshua had at least two disciples, two intimates, who were known associates of the zealots. If you turn to Luke chapter 6 and verse 15, you will read of a disciple called Simon, or Shimon, the zealot. Now, if you've got a King James version, he will be called Simon or Shimon Zelotes, which is a nice cover-up for the word zealot. But most modern versions now call him Simon the Zealot. And he's even mentioned in Acts 1 verse 13 on the day of Pentecost on Shavuot. When the Holy Spirit is given, he's there at that time, Simon the Zealot. And another, who was Yeshua's personal accountant, was the priest Judah the Sakari, or Judas Iscariot, as he's called in the King James Version. And the Sakari were known assassins. They were political assassins. They had a little short knife, sword thing, and they would go around in public, and someone they didn't like, others would prop that person up until the zealot got away, and then they'd move to the side and the bloke would fall down dead, and they'd say, "Who killed this and fight this fine man, this collaborator with Rome? Who killed him?" "You don't know, we were just standing here." Okay. Scholars place their rise later than the time period in which Yeshua and his disciples initially appeared, but this assumption is due to a dearth of documentation during this whole period of the Second Temple period. So there is no doubt, in my mind, that at least two of Yeshua's school were zealots. Then we're confronted by Shimon Kepha, or Simon Peter. He's the Galilean Yeshua's lieutenant. He's called Shimon bar Yonah, son of Jonah. All right? But according to Jewish linguistic experts in Hebrew and Aramaic, this term would read as bar Yonim, of the lawless ones, or of the extremists. So Simon Peter was not a saint. He was a heavy dude, all right, of the extremists. Now, we know that Yeshua of the Gospels is a man of peace. He said so many times. He talked about peace. But his Talmudim, his students, his school, his followers, his disciples carried swords. They carried swords. Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane? They were arresting Yeshua, and Peter draws his sword and tries to lop the guy's head off. He ducks and he cuts his ear straight off his head. All right, and Yeshua says, "Put your sword up. Put it up." The disciples wore swords. In Luke 22, have a look at this. Luke chapter 22, verse 35. He said to his disciples, "When I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, did you lack anything?" And they said, "Oh, no, Lord." He said to them, "But now, he that has a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. He that has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." It's interesting, isn't it? He says, "Buy a sword. Buy a sword. I say to you that this that is written must yet be accomplished in me. He was reckoned among the transgressors." The word transgressors here means outlaws. "For the things concerning me," he said, "will be fulfilled." And they said, "Lord, behold, we've got two swords." And he said to them, "Yeah, it's enough." So he's saying, make sure you're armed. Now, the reason I'm mentioning these finer points about Yeshua is to illustrate that he was a man's man surrounded by men's men. All right? No doubt about that. And if you look at John 18 and verse 10, I mentioned this before, so just have a look at it. Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and cut off the high priest's servant's right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. And Yeshua says to Peter, "Put up your sword into its sheath. The cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" There's also a lost version of Josephus which states that Yeshua had more than 2,000 armed followers with him on the Mount of Olives. That's the Hebrew version of Josephus. And I would be delighted.
It's not in Hebrew, isn't it?
It's not in the Greek. It's not in the Greek translation. But I would be delighted if an early untampered manuscript, one of the manuscripts penned by Josephus, surfaced again. I would be delighted to see what was actually in Josephus' Hebrew manuscript. The next point, Yeshua was recognized by the Judean populace as a king associated with a message about a kingdom. Not a spiritual king. We've got to get rid of this sentimental Christian drivel about, you know, kingdom of love. A kingdom of love in the heart. I just love Jesus. Sick of that.
It's life.
I'm sorry, guys, but I just find it so hard to handle that kind of slobber drill.
It's the whole thing of the sitting around saying holy, holy, holy.
Yeah, that's right.
He's had the angels doing that for
eternity.
Eternity. Doesn't need us to do the same thing.
Look,
if you just, you know, all it does is conjure up in my mind an image of people with little bells in their fingers and orange dresses and
we've had a few of them in our old clinic days.
We had
those in our old clinic days. They'd come through the door chanting, you know, Hari Hari. Sit down, take the time, join the queue. So, Yeshua had a message about a kingdom, and the Judean populace recognized he was a king. If you have a look, well, you know what? If not before, that alone would have alerted the Roman governor to look out for this bloke. He's calling himself a king. Watch this fellow. So if you look at Luke, it says when Yeshua enters Jerusalem, all right, he's on a whinnying, bucking, unbroken colt. Then he comes and he's got that unbroken colt under control. And the reason they knew it was an unbroken colt is because it was whinnying and bucking and trying to knock him off. And he was holding onto this thing. And what did they cry out? Blessed is the king that comes. Now this is the population of Jerusalem, and they're saying, blessed is the king that comes. Well, immediately Pontius Pilate would have gone, whoa, who is this guy? There's only one king, that's Caesar. To declare yourself a king is treason. Mm. What was on the titulus over his crucifixion? This is Yeshua the Nazarene, king of the Jews. All right? Treason. There it is, spelled out. Mark says, blessed is the kingdom that comes, the kingdom of our father, King David. No doubt about it, the Jerusalem population, all of Jerusalem, knew when Yeshua entered there was going to be trouble. And here they are declaring him as the Messiah, as the king. Pontius Pilate, Herod, all those in the court would have gone, whoa, we're in trouble. A revolution is starting. Now, Matthew says, Hosanna to the son of David. So they're recognizing that here is the Davidic Messiah as Yeshua enters Jerusalem. This was nothing more than treason. The only emperor, as I said, was Caesar. The only Jewish king was the Edomite Herod, appointed by Rome. And the only kingdom enforcing peace in the region was Rome. So what kingdom was this blessed son of David bringing into existence? And as for the term Hosanna, it's meaningless. It's meaningless. Oh, I can go into my study and I can pull out my dictionary and look up Hosanna and it'll proclaim what it's supposed to be. But that's rubbish. When the Jews called this out, they were speaking Hebrew or Aramaic. But Jerome, 4th century, in his copy of Matthew, now listen to me, in his copy, Jerome's copy of Matthew, in the 4th century, quotes this acclamation as Asana Barama. Asana Barama. Free us, son of David. Now that puts a different light on it. They were expecting him not only to be the king of Israel, the son of David, they expected him not only to be the Messiah, but that he would free them from Roman oppression. Absolutely, Lord. So when the procurator Pontius Pilate questioned Yeshua as to his kingdom, when Yeshua stood before him, he already knew all about Yeshua. He'd been getting reports from his spies, sending them to Rome, sending them to Caesar, about this articulate prophet and his movements around Judea and the Galilee. Pilate was not ruling the land of Judea in complete ignorance like some blithering idiot out of Lord of the Rings. No. Despite warnings in his own conscience and in hearing of a terrified dream by his wife, Pilate had little real choice in proceeding to crucify Yeshua for treason, because the titulus put over the head of the Messiah proclaimed him to be the king of the Jews. So he was put up there, nailed up there for treason. And he died surrounded by convicted revolutionaries crucified with him. They were not thieves. They were not robbers. I know it says that in your King James, but that's not the Greek word. The Greek word is lestai. L-E-S-T-A-I. Lestai. Which Josephus himself uses to describe Jewish underground revolutionaries, and which term had socio-political connotations. It is the same word Mark uses to describe the two men who were crucified with the Son of David. Thieves were never crucified. Never crucified.
And that was a statement to have him in the midst of those two.
Of course it was. He's the King of Nazarene, King of the Jews, and his two revolutionaries crucified with him. Now, crucifixion and beheading, you know, chop chop, were punishments specified for those who had committed treason. Remember that Herod killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. It says so in Acts 12, verse 2. With the sword. He didn't run him through. He lopped him. He beheaded him. There was no doubt in Herod's assessment that the early Yeshua movement was seen to be a politically ambitious power. Hear me? Which brings me to almost the last point. Yeshua was betrayed. Now, we all know that. We all read that. We all go, yes, the betrayal. Yeshua was betrayed. Stop! Woo! Just stop! Think of the word! Most people don't stop and think of the word. Betrayed for what? It's widely known he was betrayed. It's not understood, however, by the vast majority of Christians, because Christians have been conditioned to read the Bible without taking time out to meditate on what they read. And worse still, Christians read without questioning anything the Bible has to say. That's unhealthy. I don't care if this is the Word of God and you can say, I believe it. I don't care. We need to get back to the Bible. I don't mean back to the Bible. We need to get back to the Word of God and read what it says and believe what it actually says. Meditate on what is written so we grasp what God is saying to us. Even a scholar so respected as Merrill C. Tenney in his New Testament Times, page 174, admitted that Yeshua had a price on his head. But why would he have a price on his head? Everyone knew where he lived. The language of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark and Luke, infers that Yeshua was wanted by the Romans for much more than sharing lovely, quaint stories of lilies, little sparrows and mustard seeds. Notice the number of references to betray and similar associated words in the New Testament in relation to Yeshua. And I've forgotten to put it on the board. So, take a mental note on paper. Matthew 10:4. Matthew 17:22. You better write quickly because I'm going to race through all this. Matthew 20:18. Matthew 26, verse 2, 16, 21, 24, 25, 45, 46, 47, and 48. Chapter 27, verse
just
3 and 4.
Read that whole chapter.
That's a good idea.
I could go on. There are 32 instances of the word betrayed in, or betrayal, and words associated like that, entirely in the scriptures. 32 instances. If you want the scriptures, see me later. 32 instances of betrayal, and they appear only 4 times apart from references to Yeshua. That's how important this word betray or betrayal is in relation to Yeshua. It's used 28 times out of 32 occasions that it appears in the scripture. And the act of betrayal implies, if anything, something of perceived seditious behaviour. Clearly, the act of betrayal implies seditious behaviour. Yet it remains a term over which many students of the biblical revelation fail to stumble. They just read it and just go, oh yeah, he was betrayed. Stop and think about what you're reading. And then the next point, the zealots believed Yeshua to be sympathetic to their cause. All right, I'm building a case here. We can catch a glimpse of Yeshua's dismissal of ultimate Roman authority and control when he requests a coin from some Hellenists. Remember the incident in Mark chapter 12? These Hellenists come and they are let's read it. They're with the Pharisees. It says here in verse 13 of chapter 12 of Mark, they sent him a coalition of Pharisees and Herodians to catch him out in his own words. They're nice people. When they arrived, they said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth." Yeah, look at the slime bags.
Yeah.
Look at these slime bags. Here they come. Slurp, slurp, slurp. "You're a good man, Jesus." All right, okay, see him? See the look on their face. Then they say, directly on, after saying, "Teach the way of God in truth, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" No. "Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" Yeshua, sensing directly their acute hypocrisy, replied, and yes, you know, he's about to turn the tables on his opponents, exposing the extent of their treacherous hypocrisy. He replies, "Why do you even think to trip me up? Bring me a denarius that I may consider the issue." Someone offered a coin, and he responded, "Whose image and inscription is on this coin?" Now, please notice, he doesn't say, "Hang on a minute, I look in my pocket and grab a denarius," and he looks at it. No, he says, "Do any of you guys have a denarius?" And one of them goes, "Oh, yes." Now, please notice, he doesn't carry one. Why doesn't he carry one? You might be wrong.
Because Judas carried the money bag.
Well, yes, that's true, but why wouldn't he even look at the coin? Because he says, "Whose image and inscription is on this coin?" Right. So he's not carrying one.
He knows it anyway.
Yeah, but the point is, he's got the coin has Caesar's head on it. It has Caesar's face on it. It is Yeshua kept the commandments of God. He would not even carry a coin. He had Judas carry them, that's true. But he would not carry it himself, and he would not look at that coin. He wouldn't even glance at the coin. He did not want to violate his own conscience, because this was an idolatrous image of Caesar on a coin which was freely available in God's holy land. And there was no way he would even bring himself to even look at that coin, because on that coin was also the words Pontifex Maximus, you know, the highest priest of God. And the word Divi Augusti Filius Augustus, son of the deified Augustus. So Yeshua wouldn't even touch the coin, wouldn't look at the coin, and he says to them, "Whose image and inscription is on the coin?" Now these guys that have come to him and asked the question about tax, they produce the coin. They've got it on their person, these idolaters. All right? They said to him, "Caesar's." And Yeshua said simply, "Render to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar, and render to God the things that belong to God." And they were speechless. Of course they would be.
And may I apologise to you, because I should have known that. You've told us so many times.
Laurel, slap on the hand.
Yeah.
No, you're all right. You're contributing all the time. Don't worry about it. It's not an issue. The poll tax was a tax among a number imposed by Caesar which required every person, free or slave, to pay a Roman denarius. We're back to the taxation question. The poll tax once completely, basically indicated the size of the population because each denarius collected equaled a representative Jew. Therefore, here we get a band of rivals. The Herodians on the one hand and the Pharisees on the other. They hate each other. But to conspire against Yeshua, they join forces. I find that intriguing, these slime battles. I find this really intriguing.
To put the
other
guy out of business.
That's right. They come together to attempt to get Yeshua to make an official pronouncement about Rome's authority in Judea. Strange bedfellows. But they end up standing exposed as hypocrites. But you know what? When he said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, he was echoing, and everybody standing around watching this debate all knew it, he was echoing a zealot war cry. So here again, the zealot connection becomes apparent because the zealot's war cry was since the year 6 CE. Remember I mentioned it up here before? The zealot war cry from 6 CE was for that which is God's to God, for that which is Caesar's to Caesar. So the Holy Land was God's country, not Caesar's. And Yeshua used that very expression. Thus took advantage of the popularity of the zealots amongst the masses of the Jewish people. So the Herodians and the Pharisees went, they were speechless. Why? Because if they had come at Yeshua, the whole population would have killed him right then and there. So he simply played the game of the Herodians and the Pharisees, but he used his own rules of engagement.
Which is why, I guess, ultimately they came against him in the night.
Well, that's right. That's right. Absolutely. So Lewis Feldman is a professor of classics at Yeshiva University in New York and adjunct professor of classics, Jewish studies and history at the New York School for Social Research. He is the world's greatest authority on Josephus and the works of Josephus. Now, this is what Feldman says. Josephus ascribes to the fourth philosophy all the troubles that eventually befell the Jews of Palestine. Those who subscribe to the fourth philosophy refuse to pay tribute to the Romans. Got that up there. They advocated rebellion on the ground they could only acknowledge God as their master. Yeah, I've got that up there. But he says, unfortunately, Josephus provides us with hardly any history of the movement, and he is our only source, except that it began in 6 CE. So Feldman, Professor Feldman, dates the beginning of the zealots in 6 CE, not at the time of the rise against Rome in 66. This is most important. And he says it came in 6 CE as a result of objection to the second census of Quirinius, the Roman governor of Syria. But Luke, and you mentioned it earlier, Luke refers to a census by Caesar, right? In his gospel account of the birth of Yeshua. So if you turn over to Luke chapter 2, I'm going to wind this up in a minute, but have a look at Luke chapter 2, verse 1. It came to pass in those days that there went out from Caesar Augustus a decree that all the world should be enrolled or registered. If you've got taxed, that's wrong. That shouldn't be there. And this enrollment was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be enrolled, everyone to his own city. But please notice, it says, was first made. We read that without realizing the reference to, or in an implied reference to, two enrolments or census. Because he says, this census was first made when? So there was a second one as well. So the census was the first made, has to be dissociated from the later census of Quirinius, which Luke mentions as the spark that ignited Judas the Galilean. If you turn over to Acts 5, you'll find this in verse 37. You might say, well, what am I doing in this lecture? What I'm doing is showing the human side of Yeshua. If you look at Acts chapter 5 and verse 37, and am I saying that Yeshua was a zealot? No, I'm not saying that at all. Far be it for me to admit to that kind of nonsense. Now please notice, verse 37, this man rose up, Judas of Galilee, in the days of the enrolment, or registration. You've got taxing, take it out. And drew away much people after him. He was a Messiah, you see. He also perished, and all, even as many as obeyed him, were dispersed. Now, it's rather interesting that that actual uprising was the one in 6 CE, which Josephus refers to. It's rather interesting. So, the earliest census of Quirinius occurred in the year 3/2 BCE, a very time Yeshua was born, and was actually a registration to procure an oath of loyalty and allegiance to the Roman emperor. So, it's mentioned by Tertullian in his An Answer to the Jews, it's mentioned by Tertullian synchronizing it with the birth of Yeshua. And it is mentioned by Josephus, who says that 6,000 Pharisees refused to be associated in any way with the registration because Messiah and his age was on the immediate horizon. The Jews who turn around today, and I get emails on this every single day about the fact that Yeshua was a false Messiah, all right, and that in no way did the early Jews of the Second Temple period even expect the Messiah to appear. Well, I've got news for them. Josephus himself and Professor Feldman, another Jew, admits that in the year 3/2 BCE and in that early period, they all expected a Messiah. I've shown, and Glennis has shown in the book on Messiah's month that we jointly wrote, the Chinese expected him at that time. The Romans expected him at that time. Other pagans expected a Messiah at that time. The Jews were no exception. The pagans in Mexico expected Quetzalcoatl at that time to appear. This goes on and on and on all around the tribal lands of the world. The Messiah was expected. The Chinese expected him. For the Jews to turn around, the rabbis to turn around today and say, oh no, he wasn't expected back then. Rubbish! Liars!
I read something the other day.
That's a fact.
Where they even poo-pooed the fact that the Messiah was not. They said he was not supposed to come riding on an unbroken colt.
Yeah.
And it's
forget Zechariah.
In their own scriptures.
Forget Zechariah.
We get it from their own scriptures,
yeah,
and they deny it.
I know they deny it.
Yeah.
So.
It's all there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Josephus says 6,000 Pharisees refused to be associated with the registration because Messiah and his age was on the immediate horizon. Because of that, they said, we're going to die rather than be registered. Messiah is coming and the kingdom of God is coming. Hello? Aish.com. Hello?
Yeah.
Jewish World Review. Hello? Rabbi, this one and that one and the other one. If you're worth your circumcisions, please re-evaluate history.
Mm.
Get your head out of the sands.
Yeah.
Any blood royal claimants to thrones other than the Roman would have been singled out specifically to swear allegiance to Augustus, hence the importance Luke places on the census and the role of Miriam and Joseph, descendants of King David, returning to Bethlehem, the city of David, which coincided with Yeshua's birth. And this registration would have provided Herod with a whole list of Davidic descendants who could possibly overturn him. Right? So, Professor Feldman, again, an honest Jewish historian, is recognizing that a zealot oppositional organizational structure suddenly appeared, fully prepared for military agitation and functioning organizationally in 6 CE at the time of the second census of Quirinius. It had been evolving from the time of the birth of Yeshua and was given political birth and a warlike voice in the uprising of the nationalist Judas the Galilean. It is this second census that unites together the various factions of simmering dissidents and sets the stage for an overwhelming convulsion 6 decades later. Talk about patience. They are created in the year 6 CE, but it is not until 65 years later, because Isaiah said that the apostate Jewish nation was going to be destroyed and the kingdom of God was coming in 65 years, right? It never happened. And they took that prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 7, verse 6, through whatever, and they said, this applies to us. And they waited 65 years until the time when James was assassinated, that was in 62, and 3 years later they rose up against Rome. This is the unknown history of the Messianic movement. And we've got this information. The world doesn't have it. We've got it. There's no doubt that from 6 CE, many Jews stood in arms against Rome. Judas the Galilean was opposed to the census for 2 reasons. 1, it trampled on Jewish law, which forbade Jews to be numbered. And 2, it was a mark of enslavement to an alien heathen power. Yet history remains silent on this turbulent period. Josephus mentions the account in 6 CE and then he doesn't mention anything for another 20 years as having occurred in Judea. 20 years of silence by Josephus. His deliberately closed mouth and tight-lipped on the whole history of that period of time until Pontius Pilate comes along in 26 CE, and then Josephus starts off again talking about the history of the Jews. He's silent on that whole period for a reason. For a reason. It's a cover-up. He doesn't want us to know. He didn't want the Romans to know. And today none of us know what happened in that period of time. So what transpired to make 6 CE so important in Jewish political affairs, which it would meld the various diverse factions and the underground resistance together into a powerful alliance of blood? Turn over to Luke chapter 1 and see what Miriam's attitude was, or Mary's attitude. Because you need to keep in mind that tens of thousands had heard that the Emmanuel had finally surfaced. The idea of revolution hung heavily in the air. We've got to distance ourselves from the traditional Christian Magnificat and hear Miriam's Jewish heart speak for itself. Verse 46, chapter 1 of Luke. Miriam said, "My soul does magnify the Lord. My spirit has rejoiced in God my deliverer. He has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, from henceforth all generations shall call me blessed. For he that is mighty has done to me great things, and holy is his name. His mercy is on them that fear him from generation to generation." Now hear how she now slides in her worship of God into something else. Listen to the rhetoric. "He has displayed strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their seats. He has exalted them of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things. The rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his seed forever." This is the language, brethren, of revolution. Miriam was expectant of great things to come. There's no doubt in my mind the events of 3/2 BCE involving the births of Yochanan and his cousin Yeshua were known by everyone. The signs of God's intervention in human affairs began where it would be expected, in the temple in Jerusalem and then further afield. And when the Magi arrived to acknowledge the Emmanuel 18 months later, when Yeshua was a toddler, excitement was again rife throughout the general population. This thing was not done in a corner. Matthew said so in Matthew verse 3 of chapter 2. He says nothing was done in a corner. Everybody knew about it. Revolution was in the air, and Yeshua remained a part of it for his entire life. As I said, he had zealots who were disciples. He had armed disciples. He was recognized as a Davidic king. He was betrayed. Zealots believed Yeshua to be sympathetic to their cause because of his use of their ideology and their sayings. And he cleansed the temple with 900 zealots. Hello, don't you get the feeling that maybe there was something that linked them all together in the name of Yeshua?
He was literally carried along with the fervor of the day.
Well, what sparked the zealot mindset was the advent of the heavenly man. Now, a few weeks ago I talked about the Essene belief in the coming of the heavenly man, the Emmanuel, God with us. And the Virgin had conceived and given birth to a child after an encounter with a sky man. If you want to look into the UFO side of things, here is a sky man, and she becomes pregnant by the sky man. And this shook the very fabric of society to its knees. This was an incredible event. And years later, the insinuations began to mount because some members of the Sanhedrin sneered into Yeshua's face with the comment, "We are not born of poor man." In fact, Clarence E. Mason Jr., who wrote Prophetic Problems with an Alternative Solution, wrote in a quite a shocked state, he said, "They blatantly blasted him as a bastard." This is Professor Clarence Mason Jr. He's shocked. Jewish scholars all realize no bastard, no mamza can have a clear and pure status before the law or to the throne of David. My belief is that the mysterious 65-year prophecy period of Isaiah was tied in by the zealots with the unique advent of Yeshua in a lonely manger in Bethlehem. They saw the star arise. They remembered the prophecy in Numbers 17 that Balaam had uttered about the star coming out of Jacob, and it heralded the zealot revolution. And this is why, time and again, certain people attempted to force Yeshua's hand during his ministry, to coerce the Messiah to reveal himself to the world and to take power. And there must have been formidable temptations, in my view. And don't forget that both Peter and Jude, in their letters, describe zealots as being in the assembly with the saints. You can read the descriptions in 2 Peter and in Jude. The zealots are there, portrayed as being Christians. And Josephus uses the same derogatory description in his writings about the zealots. They're the same people. It's almost like Peter and Jude sat down and copied Josephus, or Josephus sat down and copied Jude and Peter. It's just that they're describing the same people. All right. Don't forget the words of a particular zealot revolutionary who was on the tree with Yeshua. Remember his dying words? He said, "Remember when you come into your kingdom." He knew Yeshua was a king. He knew Yeshua had a kingdom because he'd heard him teaching zealots. Now, Yeshua is being tortured by the Roman soldiers. I'm going to finish on this note, tie it in with the entire first miracle of turning water into wine. Yeshua is being tortured by the Roman soldiers. In this degrading episode, he has a crown, please note, a crown of thorns thrust down on his scalp. And a reed is put in his hand to imitate a scepter, as Matthew records. And he's got a purple cloak on him, a symbol of royalty. So these Romans saw Yeshua as a zealot king. It would have been amusing to the Romans because Yeshua was being tried for treason. because his followers believed he was the king of the Jews, and of course he was. The pagan Romans worshipped Caesar as both king and a god. So it would have been equally humorous for the Zealots, because they were busily engaged in promoting themselves as the alternative rule of government for Judea. The Zealots were creating unrest and agitation throughout the Roman Empire, and here was their king in Roman hands. So the boys from Rome had a working knowledge of Aramaic, which the Zealots all spoke. Now please notice this fact. The Aramaic word for zealot is kenayah, and reed in Aramaic is kena. So there's a real play on words going on here as they swiped and lashed Yeshua's body with these reeds and then acted out a sort of mock worship with the reed in his hands as a monarch. You read about that in Matthew 27, verse 29. Yeshua's first miracle, as attested by the priestly John, was the sign of his messiahship, turning water into wine. And where did this great event occur? In Cana. In Galilee. Where did the revolution start? In 6 CE in Galilee. Judas the Galilean led it. And in his pre-crucifixion torture, as the blood flowed red, sorry, I love my Messiah. A reed, a cana, is thrust into his hands. Into those bloody hands, which transmuted water into wine. And this cana thrust into his hands was the symbol of not just a miracle, but of his kingship and lordship of all. Am I saying that Yeshua was a zealot? Of course not. But I also consider the evidence as found in the Gospels, and I come to a different conclusion to modern authors, because John has presented the ministry of his Lord throughout the pages of his Gospel in such a way to show that this peaceful Son of God, this Logos from eternity, was from the very beginning responsible because of that inner driving force, the Holy Spirit of God, coercing him to work out his own salvation. Remember, Yeshua had to earn salvation. Believe it or not, he had to earn salvation so we could be saved by grace. We don't work for our salvation. We work our salvation out, but we are not saved by what we do or we don't do. Yeshua had to work out his own salvation and ours as first fruits by manipulating people. Hear me? By manipulating people and events to bring about God the Father's purposes. Salvific purposes.
Setting himself up all the time.
The more miraculous was this the case as he worked with and within the free will of others, probably destining or predetermining them from eternity to act and react and to be proactive when engaging with him. Astonishing. It blows my mind when you think about it. If this is the case, and I believe it is, he had to be at the right place at the right time in order to manipulate, as I have said, both people and events to his own peculiar timing. This is why all the way through the Gospel of John he says, my hour is not yet come, my hour is not yet come, my hour is not yet come. And then he says, my hour is now. He had to work out his hour. And therefore we feel the glow of the power of the Logos once again shining through the writings of John. It is not just the Son of God who is there with Kana in his hands. It is the Logos in human flesh that created the universe. That is exciting to my mind. The miracle begins with the turning of water into wine, the first sign, at Cana, and here in the bloodied hands of the Creator. is a kena, a reed. A reed. There's no doubt in my mind that Yeshua deliberately plotted all his actions which culminated in the tragic events of his final week and drew simultaneously thousands of innocent people along in his wake. That is a responsibility I would never have wanted. I could never have burdened. I couldn't have borne it. Neither could you. And let me say this with absolute dogmatism. He did it all in order to fulfill messianic prophecies. His assault on the temple, its occupation, established his role as the alternative high priest, the only authentic high priest over God's spiritual house. And don't forget, the Bible says he is our apostle. There's only one apostle today. That's our high priest, the apostle, Yeshua, the Messiah. If anybody sets themselves up as an apostle of God, they are liars. There is only one apostle, as there is only one high priest, Yeshua. The miracle which began in Cana of the Galilee and which ushered in his ministry of salvation ends with the miracle of the Cana held in his hands, the hands that created the universe as the Logos. Having said all that today, we are now in the process, as we flow into this series of lectures, to discuss the issue of the cursing of the fig tree, which cannot be dislocated from the first sign, turning Jewish ceremonial water into salvific messianic wine. Having said all that today, I'm exhausted. Are there any questions from anybody on it?
There's the role of Nicodemus who came to Yeshua in the night sort of be a covert sort of meeting.
You know? It certainly was.
Is there, is there anything to do with Nicodemus regarding the role in the temple cleansing and the getting guards on the side?
I think there is, but it's not in the Bible. And I've searched history and I can't find any connection. But I'm sure there was.
Well, you mentioned the temple,
because he also... They would have. They had to, by Caiaphas. You're talking about the temple police and all that.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Nicodemus soon had to be very loyal like later on after Christ.
That's right. Extremely loyal. Yeah. Extremely loyal.
He lost his family, didn't he?
Yes. And so was not only Nakdamon, not only Nicodemus, but also Joseph of Arimathea. They were both members of the Sanhedrin. And they came at the last. And they're very, very powerful.
But
Nakdamon Ben-Gurion, oh yeah, they stuck their neck out. Nakdamon was the most wealthy Jew in the Second Temple period, and it was his finance that financed not only, we now realize, the Zealot Revolution, but also thousands and thousands of families were supported with the grain that he made freely available to them. He saved them during the revolution, a lot of families. Nicodemus. So, you know, there is a side of the biblical revelation which is fascinating and yet becomes more evident when you look at history as having a pertinence to where we are today.
Yeah, so
and who we are.
A rounding off of things, isn't it?
Absolutely. A rounding off.